Hello and welcome to Escape from Lockdown, the show all about how we got into this madness and how we are going to get out of it. Now, if there's one person who's been very movingly profound throughout all of this and whose reputation has grown, at least for me and for the lockdown skeptic community, it is the wonderful Bob. Or more specifically, Bob Moran, the cartoonist from The Telegraph and The Sunday Telegraph. And his cartoons have been so wonderful, so witty and so funny, and sometimes quite sad, that they've really been something of an artistic heart in this whole process. I think Peter Hitchens is now on has a thing where he just posts Bob's new cartoon every week and just says, Bob Moran gets it. Bob, you do get it, and welcome to the show. How's it going?
Thank you, Alex. Well, thank you very much for having me. And this is my first ever podcast, so I'm a little bit nervous.
I have to thank you for letting me take your podcast virginity then.
You're very welcome, and I trust you'll be gentle with me.
I promise to show you a good time. So before we get cracking, can you tell us about a little bit about how you got into being cartooning and how being a cartoonist and how you managed to carve out a living doing it? Because I know many artists and it's a real challenge.
Yes, I mean, that's the short answer. It's very, very difficult. It's a very strange ambition to have to begin with anyway. And there aren't many people who, A, want to do it, and B, have what it takes, I suppose. And I don't just mean the talent, but the area of interest, the fact that you've got to be able to work to such tight deadlines. You can't be too precious about your art. You have to be okay with editors interfering with it. All these things have to converge to make a successful newspaper cartoonist. And I realised at a very early age that the thing I could do particularly well was draw pictures that made other people laugh. And I got a real kick out of that. But I was never very political, and my family wasn't political. I don't remember there ever being a newspaper in the house growing up. The only politics I remember as a child is the fact that my dad kept losing his job. And I once asked him why, and he said, it's John Major's fault. That was about all I had as a political view. And then when I was about 14 at school, I had an excellent art teacher called Andy Denham, who came into the lesson one day and put two of his own Gerald Scarfe books in front of me. And he said, I want you to go home tonight, look at these and have a think about what you might want to do when you leave school. And I remember going back in the next day and saying to him, I think I want to be a political cartoonist. And he said, yes, I think you ought to be. I said, how do I do it? And he said, I've got absolutely no idea. And that really was the case right up until I became one, because there is no set path. There's no route. You can't go and do a degree in it. No jobs are advertised. There's no way of training for it, really, other than doing it for real. And so I ended up going to university and studying illustration for my degree, which I was able to work in political cartooning into that. And after university, I just spent a lot of time working in hotels and bars and all kinds of weird jobs and sending work to editors of newspapers and magazines whenever I could, in the hope that they might give me an opportunity.
So it's just unsolicited submissions, basically, that you were doing?
Yes. I did the odd bit of work for small publications for a bit of money, but generally I was just working in my free time and sending work to people and saying, I'd like to do cartoons for you. I got to know over those few years, I started to get to know some of the other cartoonists. I'd go down to London to events and exhibitions and things, and I got to know Martin Rosen at The Guardian very well, and Steve Bell and Morton Moreland, and they were all very helpful and encouraging. And eventually in 2010, I did a stint over the summer doing some cover for Steve Bell and Martin Rosen at The Guardian. And
Did they recommend you? Did they say, RML, what about this guy Bob?
You know, do you want they had this idea. They sort of set it up with, there are a few of us. There are a group of, I think, six of us who they had known for a while, who were mostly young people interested in getting into it. So they convinced the paper to set up this thing over the summer where they showcased new talent, sort of aspiring cartoonists, while they went on holiday. And they invited us all for a dinner in London beforehand and briefed us on it and gave us some advice. And then we did a sort of debrief afterwards. And the following April, I was offered this position at The Telegraph, and I've been there ever since.
How wonderful. And now you have this space just to do your art. And then, unfortunately, the world has collapsed all around us, so it's not so wonderful anymore. So that's what I wanted to get into. So, obviously, one of the first cartoons in this whole process, which really caught my eye, was very, very early on. And it was a man sitting in his pants, I think, with a little bottle of beer, and he's watching Netflix. And he's just sat on his armchair. And it has one of those, you know, old Lord Kitchener kind of posters, tags. He's doing his part, are you?
Yeah.
And that, the Bob that drew that is not the Bob that I'm looking at in the Zoom call right now. The Bob I'm looking at is much more angry. So can you tell me about how that journey from doing this quite gentle, broadly supportive, I'd say.
Cautious, those early cartoons, yeah.
But so tell me how that change happened.
I think I, like a lot of people at the beginning, was very careful. I think none of us knew exactly what this was going to be. I'll go right back to the very first cartoon I drew about it, which was on the 7th of February.
Right.
It was just after Brexit had happened, and there'd been this huge fanfare, and, you know, for the Telegraph, that was a massive celebratory event.
Yeah.
And it was like the come down after that had happened. And I remember thinking, what am I going to do now? The rest of the year is going to be so dull. You know, we've got Brexit's happened. That debate is going to peter out. We've got a Conservative government with an 80-seat majority. Boris Johnson is Prime Minister. Telegraph readers adore him. I'm going to spend the rest of the year doing pictures of him doing a great job.
Yeah.
And on this day, there wasn't much news around. And I remember speaking to my editor and saying, well, what about this virus thing?
Right.
And he said, well, yes, it has now. It's left China now. They're declaring that it could be a pandemic. So you should probably do a cartoon about it. And, you know, in my job, I have to look at news stories and make an assessment about how long could this run for? You know, how many cartoons might I end up having to do about this? And I thought, this will probably be the only cartoon I ever do.
Because,
you know, in a week's time, it will arrive and it will spread around, but it will peter out and the media will move on to something else.
I'll just describe it now for the viewer, because I just pulled it up in front of me. We've got the Earth, alone in space. And it's got a face mask pulled around it as if it's a face. And it's the mask just on the top of the band. It says Made in China. And it's interesting how you've managed to make the Earth look a bit facial as well, which is quite nice. Sorry, go on.
Well, this is way before face masks became the issue they are now.
Yeah.
You know, back then, face masks was just something people in Asia wore a lot. You know, and people were still saying, "Oh, we could never do anything like that here." It's fascinating to think back to that day and this discussion of, "Well, I better do one just to cover the issue, just one cartoon. And then, like most people, the information started to come out. Now, I was quite worried for a time, for a week or so. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when they released the information about who was in the at-risk categories, and one of the things they said was anyone with cerebral palsy is at very high risk. And our daughter has cerebral palsy. She's wow. 7. And so obviously, we took her out of school that day and said, you know, and we're genuinely worried. I mean, that just that piece of information alone turned out to be pretty irresponsible, because actually the reason they put them on the list was more to do with the fact that, that if they had carers, they might not be able to go and work for them.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to anything specifically to do with the condition.
So it's very early on, the spectre of fear as exactly. a raises its head.
Yeah. And also my brother, who is one of the sort of probably the cleverest person I know, I remember him phoning me up and saying, I think you should be worried about this. You know, this seems bad. And certainly in terms of the cartoons I was doing, it felt like that I had a degree of responsibility not to call it a certain way before I was sure about that, you know. And so it's those early cartoons, like the one you refer to about the guy watching Netflix in his armchair. It could be interpreted as sarcastic, you know, which I liked about it. You could look at it and say, how ridiculous that this is what we're being asked to do, you know, compared with what people were asked to do during the Second World War, to fight a real enemy.
Is that why you made him so anachronistic? Because he's got this big Victorian moustache, he's smoking a pipe.
Yeah, I wanted it to be referencing those World War II posters. You know, the careless talk costs lives, that type of thing.
Actually, if I could just stop for 1 second, listener, if this is for the listener, if you're on a laptop or something, just go to bobmoran.co.uk, and then Bob's actually got all his cartoons there and dated as well. So it might be quite fun for this podcast, you know, if we've referred to something, you can look it up as well, and then we can all look at it and talk about it, which I think might be rather fun. Anyway, so carry on.
So I think it was, it's hard to gauge exactly when my mind started to change. I do remember listening to some interviews with Peter Hitchens on some podcasts, I don't remember which ones, but I had began to suspect that the whole response was disproportionate, a massive overreaction, and I had started to look at what the situation has always been in regards to respiratory infections amongst the elderly and influenza, and the way we deal with this type of virus. And it didn't really make any sense to me that we were suddenly reacting in this way. And I listened to an interview with Peter Hitchens, and he just completely crystallized everything that I had suspected. And I remember just thinking, yeah, this is actually a very dangerous path we're going down with all of this. So then I began to change tack dramatically with the cartoons I was putting out. And I was very lucky to be working for a newspaper that was happy for me to do that, because at the time there really wasn't very much in the rest of the newspaper that was anti-lockdown or trying to show the whole thing in a different light. And I think it's one of the advantages of being a cartoonist is that sometimes you are allowed to say things that wouldn't be permitted in the rest of the newspaper.
So you're almost like the little boy pointing out the emperor has no clothes, or you know, the sort of conscience.
Part of the role is being the court jester, you know, who is allowed to say the things that other people aren't. and poke fun at the people in power. That's certainly a big part of it. I then, around the same time, I began to realise that other cartoonists weren't doing that.
Yes. This is what I wanted to talk about, actually. Are there any other cartoonists making these statements with their drawings?
Well, I think what I'll say first of all is that, as I alluded to earlier, I'm good friends with a lot of the other cartoonists, and they've I respect them enormously, and a lot of them have done a great deal to help me, especially early on in my career. So I don't want to talk about any individual
people.
But it is very interesting to me that, for years, the others would say, when we met up, they would say things to me like, how can you do it? How can you work for the Tory graph? How can you bear it? You're just churning out Conservative Party propaganda on a weekly basis. This year, I've done the opposite, and they have all started churning out Tory propaganda. It's as if they've all been employed by Matt Hancock to paint his vision of fear and panic. I think the moment I realised how stark it was, the difference was, there was a week in the summer, I don't know if you remember, when everybody started flocking to the beaches.
Yes.
And you had all the pictures of the packed beaches on the
Bournemouth
front pages.
And I
think, like most sensible people, thought, great,
this
is what we need.
Yeah.
But those on the other side of the argument were panicking and convinced this would kill millions of people. And I did a cartoon that week that's one of my most popular that I've done, which was of a family of beachgoers, of ordinary beachgoers, walking down the road towards the beach, and they're walking past a house with a couple in their garden wearing full hazmat suits, and holding a sign saying, the end is nigh, and this couple are looking at the family on their way to the beach saying, just look at them.
Yeah.
Complete lunatics. But the week that I did that, I think almost every other cartoonist in every other newspaper did an image of death walking along the beach or sunbathing next to people. The complete opposite message. And I suddenly realised how alone I was among my peers in actually taking this side of the argument.
What's it like being alone?
It's been disappointing to an extent. I mean, one thing to say is you can never be sure how much individual cartoonists are being pushed in a particular direction by their editors. It may well be the case that some of them don't want to put out that message, but they've been told, look, this is our paper line. We are supporting the government in promoting this idea that COVID is horrific and terrifying, and that's what you have to do as well. But I have always felt that the main role of a cartoonist is to hold a government to account, particularly when something as serious like this is going on. And if a political party is desperately trying to push an idea on its people that you as a cartoonist feel is totally wrong and inaccurate, you have such a great opportunity, because you are working visually, to very efficiently put out the opposite image and the opposite message. And it's very difficult being alone and slightly disappointing that other cartoonists haven't taken up the fight, but I've never felt more engaged with my work. I've never been more passionate about what I'm doing, and I've never found it as rewarding as I have this year. I mean, I get so many lovely messages of support from people, and people saying that my work has made a genuine difference to how they feel Even some people have said that, you know, it's changed their mind about seeing people, you know, their loved ones and things. People, I had a guy who hadn't seen his girlfriend for 6 weeks or something and saw one of my cartoons and said, I've decided we must see each other now and we'll never be apart again. I mean, that's heartbreaking, but
yeah,
it stuff like that keeps me going. Yeah.
It's certainly, I mean, I post the odd one on my Facebook and people react to them. I think the one, yeah, I've got it in front of me now, 10th of September, and it's a grandmother reaching out of her arms as her grandson is being pulled away by a policeman wearing a face mask. And it's something that hit me quite hard, actually, because even though, Mum, if you're listening, you don't look that old. But, you know, I've got
she's
a 10-month-old.
She's a cartoon. Cartoon grannies always look very old. I'm aware that most of them are very glamorous young women.
Yes, exactly. They're de-aging, in fact. But, yeah, it's exactly that. You know, I have a 10-month-old, and I can see how much happiness that he brings my mum. And early on, it was very hard that it was a good, I think, 2 or 3 months they went without seeing him. And when, as you know, actually, because you have kids, they change so much in that time. And I mentioned this on my podcast last week with Annabelle. I don't know how much detail I went into, but my nephew is 2 in Australia. And I think my mum probably last saw him a year ago and probably won't see him until he's maybe even 4, you know, the way that they're going, you know, not letting Australians out, there's quarantine, all this. And that time is really precious because it's gone. You know, if you don't see a 30-year-old for 4 years, they're not that different when they're 34, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If you miss that baby time, that's gone. And that's a beautiful time. And it just sort of really slammed it into me, that one. And,
it's a beautiful time. And I think once you've had children of your own, you do see life differently and you understand the value of life in a slightly different way. And then I think certainly when your children go on to have their own children, you become a grandparent and you have... certainly live more than half of your own life. These things, those things, those moments and that time with your family become more precious than anything else.
Yeah.
And it's certainly more precious than your own longevity. You know, I think so many of these elderly people that we're supposed to be protecting or saving would much rather be allowed to take the risk and just have that time with their families. It is totally barbaric. I mean, my grandmas both died, sadly, at the beginning of this year, around Christmas time, within a month of each other, actually. And they were both around 90, and they were both really quite poorly, and had been for some time. One of them was in a home quite near to where we live, and we would go and visit her every week with my children because it was her favourite thing in the world, seeing her great-grandchildren, hugging them and kissing them and having a chat with them.
Wow.
And it could well be the case that we gave her something.
Yeah.
You know, we gave her a bug, and that's what ended up killing her. I mean, she had very advanced cancer, and so it's likely that was what killed her. Actually, the way she died is quite beautiful because she was a very glamorous lady, and they went to wake her up in the morning to get ready for breakfast. Apparently, she got dressed, she went in to the bathroom, put all of her makeup on, did her hair, lay back down on her bed, and died.
Oh.
And when they went back to get her, for breakfast, she, you know, she was gone, but she looked immaculate. And it's so wonderful because that's exactly what she would have wanted. Yeah.
I almost suspect that she almost knew, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's so often the case. Yeah. You get a sense with that people either know that it's time and sort of get themselves ready, or they decide that they've had enough and just sort of clock out in their sleep.
Yeah.
But I don't regret a single visit to her. Mm. And I don't, it doesn't make me feel guilty that, well, what if we gave her an illness or anything like that? Because I know that the most precious thing in the world to her at that point was seeing her family.
Yeah.
And this is what we've lost. This, you know, all life is precious. Mm. We all, as a starting point, all decent people would say and agree that all life is precious. And as a result of that, we want to do everything we can to protect it. But there is a difference between sanctity of life and quality of life. Mm. And in various circumstances, in various situations, you have to make a judgment between those two things. And where that line is, it varies slightly depending on what the situation is. But by and large, over time, people have generally agreed on how that balance works. Hmm. Until March of this year, when we suddenly threw it out of the window and turned it on its head.
And I suspect as well that the calls for don't kill Granny, and this idea that this is an altruistic act is bollocks, and I think people themselves are scared when they shouldn't be. You know, young millennials are scared. I mean, I only have to look at sort of the community Facebook groups, and you have people who are perfectly young, perfectly healthy, who say, oh, you know, I've not been on a tube for 6 months and I have to go on a journey tomorrow. Like, what's it like? I had to think, oh my God, what are you on about? Yes. This is crazy. This is the wrong way to live.
Yeah, and you know, see a lot of people who are clearly boasting about how they haven't left their house for 6 months.
Yeah.
They think, what a strange thing to be proud of.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the don't kill Granny thing, I mean, two of the things about that that interest me. One is that this is not an unprecedented situation. I think a lot of people are under the impression that suddenly, for the first time ever in our history, we're faced with a situation where when we leave the house in the morning, we might kill someone we don't even know just by breathing out.
Mm.
And that's been the case throughout all of human history. There has never been a time when you weren't at risk of doing that when you left the house. More so in the past. I mean, think about the kind of diseases and plagues that were around for hundreds of years.
I mean, it wasn't just more so, it was orders of magnitude more so. You know, I mean, I'm sure you're like me, you've been very much enjoying these graphs that people put out on Twitter.
Yes.
And I love, you know, sort of shout out to Ivy Cummings, Alistair Haynes, Hector Drummond, Dan the statistics guy, Ruminator Dan, also John the statistics guy. the graphs of like how people used to die in the sort of 19th century is insane. You know, the sort of cholera epidemics and the diphtheria epidemics, you know, killed so many more people, and people just got on with it because they understood that that was a fact of life. And I don't want to be one of these people who says, you know, oh, you know, there's nothing you can do about it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's more that there are things we do about it. Medicine is an evolutionary process. You know, our understanding evolves. You know, it doesn't come from just suddenly imposing massive societal change and assuming that that'll do well. And fundamentally, we haven't got the foggiest clue how well we are living right now. You know, for most people in history, for most of the time, life was nasty, brutish, and short. Mm. You know, we could be Chinese peasants in the sort of 5th century. You know, we could be hunter gatherers who had her brain smashed out of a rock by a rival, you know, interest for our mate. You know, that's what life was. And now we're incredibly comfortable and we're worried about this minuscule thing and taking away all the benefits that modern life brings us, which make it worth living.
I mean, it comes down to personal responsibility. What is an individual's obligation towards other members of society? How far should that extend? Because, you know, what I was saying about it's always been the case that everyone could potentially infect someone else's granny with a virus they didn't even know they were carrying. Most people haven't been aware of that their whole lives, and that's actually very important.
Yeah.
Because if we were all told that at age 5 or something, or if there was a little speaker on everybody's front door that reminded them as they left the house, people would go insane.
Mm.
We would have no society. People wouldn't be able to function. But doctors and scientists have always known that.
Mm.
And they have decided, no, it's not appropriate to tell everybody that that's what's happening. Because we need people to live a free life, and we need to balance the risks that we're all taking all of the time. So behind the scenes, we will work away at trying to limit what damage these things cause, but we won't make everybody aware of it. And it's because one of the key reasons is, you know, if you're out and about in society, you do have a certain obligation towards your fellow human beings in terms of keeping them safe. If you're driving a car, you don't run over them. You know, if you're smoking a cigarette, you don't stand next to somebody with a pram. There are things that you are obliged to do that are just polite, if nothing else. But there has always been a clear limit. And one of those limits is you are not responsible for infecting somebody else with an illness that you might be carrying that you don't know that you have that may end up killing them. And it's really important that we have that limit, because once you take it away, almost anything is possible. I mean, if this may sound hyperbolic, but with these things are escalating so quickly,
not in this
hyperbole
age.
Quickly becomes reality.
Yeah,
but let's say in a few years' time it is possible to prove beyond reasonable doubt exactly who gave somebody a virus that had killed them. Could that person be tried for murder?
My God.
You know, is that where we're headed?
Yeah.
You cannot make individual people this responsible for others. It's incredibly dangerous and morally illiterate, in my view.
And there's the false equivalence of being drawn. So you mentioned not smoking someone near a pram, or driving is a good one. And, you know, we're being told, oh, you know, this is just the same, you know, why not live in a world without speed limits? You know,
right.
And I just think, oh, go away. That's rubbish. And,
well, yeah, the driving argument is fascinating because people often bring it up. I mean, seatbelts, people use seatbelts as a comparison to face masks and things. I mean, all you need to say to that is, you know, wearing a seatbelt does not degrade you as a human being. It doesn't prevent you from smiling at another person when you see them in a car. You know, it is an entirely different concept, the idea of putting a seatbelt on. But
and seatbelts work.
And they've been proven to work, absolutely. There's no debate. I mean, what I say to people about masks, and this really confuses some people, but if there were absolutely no doubt in the scientific community, if every scientist on Earth was 100% agreed on the fact that masks work, I would still say we shouldn't have mandatory masks.
I 100% agree.
This virus is not serious enough to justify that massive societal change and the damage it will cause. You know, I would say, maybe if it had a 60 or 70% mortality rate, that's when you should be saying everyone must wear a mask. And what I always then say is, of course, if that were the case, you wouldn't have to tell anybody to do these things. They'd just do it.
Yeah.
Because they would actually see it. They'd walk out of their door and see people dying. you know, and then they'd run back into their house.
I mean, yeah, it's another key thing about the house.
Yeah. But yes, I mean, road traffic fatalities is a fascinating comparison in the sense that the average age of someone who dies in a road traffic fatality in the UK is about 37.
Right.
Okay, so the loss of life in terms of how many years of life is being lost is
double.
It's comparable to the life that has been lost to COVID, or more importantly, the lives we think we've saved from doing what we've done, which is, the last time I checked, was a maximum of 20,000 people. I mean, I doubt it's anything like that, but assume that it is 20,000 people with an average age that's more than the average life expectancy in the UK. It's not as great a loss of life as people who die in road traffic accidents every year. And what do we do about that? You know, there are so many things we could do to try and limit those deaths. We could have a national speed limit, an upper speed limit of 50 miles an hour everywhere. We could ban non-commercial vehicles from driving on the motorway. You know, we could have driving tests every 2 years for everybody. There's so many things we can do, but we don't.
Well, why stop at 50? Why don't you go to 30 or 20? You know,
yeah, exactly.
It's probably less of a societal change than this is.
Exactly. But what has always happened is tiny, tiny adjustments government make, you know, over many years. You know, they introduce the theory test as well as the practical driving test. You know, they put up more speed cameras. They have average speed checks. They increase the fines a tiny bit. That's how these things have always worked in the past. You know, if we hardly do anything for people dying on the roads, why are we ripping apart the whole of society, destroying everything for this? You know, you can't. That's the interesting comparison. Not, oh, well, you wear a seatbelt when you drive, why shouldn't you wear a mask?
Yeah.
That's not the right way of looking at it.
It's why do we let people drive?
Yes.
And that raises an interesting thing on the mask subject. Because
sorry, this is my wife.
Hello, my wife. How's it going? So, there's some realism into the podcast. I don't know if anybody heard. I had to move rooms because next door decided now is the perfect time to do some hammering.
I wondered what that was. I thought it was something in my house.
No. It's me. I mean, they've been on it for a few days now. Selfish. So. Mars is an interesting one as well, because as a cartoonist, and specifically as a, you're almost like a caricaturist a lot of the time, faces are such an important part of what you do and understanding them. Can you, this is something that's always interested me as well, because I, as a rule, I can't really draw. I'd love to, and I've tried to, I can do the occasional kind of like crap mountain vista, but that's kind of it. So faces have always been really hard for me. And, you know, one of the things a friend of mine pointed out when I was in my 20s, that when you draw a face, you put the eyes in the middle and not at the top of the head like children do. You know, I was still had, and as soon as I did that, I thought, wow, like that's changed the way I do a face completely. But How do you copy a face? How do you caricature a face by drawing?
Well, it's different with every new person that you have to draw. You have to find your way around their face and work out a way in. So work out where do I start with this person, because it's slightly different for every person. For example, with Donald Trump, I always start with his hair and then work from there.
Right.
With Boris Johnson, I would tend to start with his eyes. With Theresa May, I usually started with her nose, I think. So it's slightly different every time. You have to work out what are their key features, what works if you exaggerate it and what doesn't, because a lot of people think, oh, you just exaggerate everything with a caricature, but that doesn't actually work. You have to pick which things can be stretched, and some things, with some things it's the opposite. With some things you either leave them out or you reduce them. And then you have to establish, how do I want to draw this person that's different, slightly different from how other people draw them? Because you sort of, you're trying to, what I try to do is almost turn them into my own little characters based on the real person, if that makes sense. But yeah, you're right. I mean, faces have always fascinated me. They have always been the thing that I've enjoyed drawing the most. And as a result, I think I am more aware than other people are, and more critical. I wouldn't say critical, but I analyse faces around me a lot.
Yeah.
You know, when I tell people, when I meet them, what I do, they will often sort of recoil and say, "Oh, I bet you're looking at me thinking, what great material." And I always politely say, "No, of course not." But they're right. That is exactly what I'm thinking.
Because that's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah. And it's not a good way to make friends, telling people that.
Yeah, I should have done this as a video.
But I one of the things in my work that I really am acutely aware of is how important facial expression is. If you're drawing a cartoon and you're trying to make a joke work, it can often hinge on the expression on a character's face. You know, if they look frightened, worried, self-confident, angry, whatever it is, the gag won't work if they don't have the right expression. And so often it comes down to a single line or even just the angle of the mouth. You know, a tiny adjustment can change the way people read that face. And, you know, that's what we're doing all the time. We're walking around seeing other faces coming towards us, and our brains are constantly making an assessment, you know, reading that face. And it's partly, it's something that's evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. It's partly a survival mechanism because we want to see whether that person means to do us harm. And it's the quickest, most efficient way of doing that. But it's also just the easiest means of communication between people. You know, I mean, just think about a smile, smiling. Let's just isolate smiling.
Yeah.
How important a smile is to our interaction with strangers, with our children, with our friends, with everybody. A smile can make a massive difference. I mean, I've heard stories, you hear stories quite a lot about people who are in a really low place. And a smile from a stranger can change their mind about what they may have intended to do. It's an incredibly powerful gesture. As a parent, I'm sure you'll have experienced it. You know, when you have a young child and you go out and you're shopping, not anymore, but it used to be the case that, you know, a kind old lady or someone would smile and smile at your baby and talk to you, and, you know, your baby would giggle at them, and it's a wonderful experience. It's a wonderful interaction.
It's like heroin for me. It's because my baby, if I can brag, my baby is really smiley, and he's always giggling and laughing at things, and it's so great. You know, I hear people all the, like, I was walking down the park with him strapped to my front, and this girl quite a way away saw him, and she said to her boyfriend or whoever, "I think I've just made a friend."
Yeah.
Right? You know, because she saw
him. And then possibly, "I want one of those, please."
I mean, I think she was of that age. You know, you're a father, I'm a father. I think we know how this happens.
I mean, that's great to hear, because your son has obviously spent a great deal of his life shut away from other children and other people. And one of the great dangers of not letting babies socialize is that they don't pick up those basic functions of interacting with people, smiling and laughing and taking those social cues.
I mean, I've seen people where I live, I don't know about you. I mean, I think you probably live out, you live somewhere quite rural and nice, don't you?
I'm in the middle of nowhere, yes.
So I'm in the middle of East London, and I see like 4-year-olds with face masks.
And I've seen that too. Yeah,
it's just it's disgusting. It really annoys me, and it sort of pisses me off like for the rest of the walk down the street because it's just utterly, utterly, profoundly wrong. And the arguments that get used for face masks are they're sort of bizarre, aren't they? Because on the one hand, some people have this completely inflated idea of how they work, and they think, you know, this is why Asian countries have done well. My favourite one is that this is why the Black Lives Matter process didn't set off a giant epidemic because
they were all wearing masks.
They're all wearing masks, which they weren't, but whatever. But there's another aspect of it, which is people say, look, even if it only improves things by a tiny factor, it's worth doing. And it's such a minimal imposition. And in any case, it's only temporary. And I just think, is it now?
Mm.
Is it? Mm. Because a lot of people are saying, no, this is years. Why don't we look across to the rest of Europe? You know, we copied them pretty comprehensively when it came to lockdown in the first place. So I think Italy now, masks are compulsory everywhere.
Yes.
You know, and so imagine that from the moment you step out your door, you could be fined for not wearing a mask, you know, and it's ironic because in France, you could be fined for wearing a burqa until a few years ago. And in a year's time, they maybe fine you for not wearing one.
It's extraordinary. The burqa situation in France. I mean, the mask issue has forced me to remember, what my views were about the burqa debate, which I found very complicated for a long time. Because culturally it's complicated. There's a lot of history behind it. There's a lot of difficulties with the fact that there are lots of women who do just choose to wear it, and that's what they want to wear. And then there are other women who are forced to wear it, which is an entirely different thing. But I remember coming to the conclusion that actually I had absolutely no problem with the burqa, which refers to the entire outfit, the whole covering, when you can see the person's face. Because as far as I'm concerned, that's not really any different to seeing a goth walking around in a big black trench coat and boots. If you can see somebody's face, they are sending a signal to the world that I'm open, I'm part of this community, I don't mean you any harm, I'm not trying to hide anything, I'm approachable, you can tell whether I'm upset, whether I'm anxious, whether I'm friendly, whether I want to engage you in a conversation, all of these things. And I think that's fine. But specifically the niqab, which is what Boris Johnson infamously referred to as a letterbox, when all you can see is their eyes, I realise that is what is causing all of this debate. That is the thing that some people find unpleasant. And it's because of all the things we've just been talking about. Because when people cover up their faces, you can tweet and shout and scream all day long that, oh, I have no problem with it. It really doesn't bother me. Your brain has a problem with it because your brain is programmed to read faces. That's why we see faces everywhere. We see faces in slices of toast and folds of curtains and clouds in the sky, because it's hardwired into us. If you suddenly start taking that away, it's really hard for your brain, for your processing that happens. And yes, eventually maybe your brain will get used to it, but that's going to be a very bad thing. That's going to be a very bad thing. If a society, for example, let's go back to smiling. Eventually, if nobody is allowed to smile in public, which is now the case currently, you know, The government has essentially made it illegal to smile at,
well,
it's
illegal to smile indoors at the moment, I think. Not in your house.
If you're not in your house.
Yeah, it's in your public place. But then, thankfully, for the moment, the nutters have not taken over our outdoor space. But
yeah,
I feel very strongly.
In some countries they have, though.
Some countries they have, and that's why every single thing that they bring in, no matter what it is, has to be fought against. Because if you just let people do this, these people are panicked. These people they're not thinking rationally, these advisors and these scientists and these activists. They will push as far as they can go. They absolutely will, because you just have to read what they're saying. You know, it's not a conspiracy if they're telling you what they want to do.
No. As Peter Hitchens constantly reminds people, that it was their strategy at the beginning to instill as much fear as they possibly could. You know, they realised it was a problem. People weren't scared enough, and they needed to bring in measures to make people more afraid. But I mean, just to go back to,
I cut you off there.
No, it's fine, because I think I just wanted to finish the point really with smiling, which is that, as you have pointed out, it's clear this clearly isn't a temporary thing. You know, we lots of people now are talking about years. If it's long term, at the moment you go out and you see people, you can just about tell in their eyes that they're still trying to smile at each other.
Yeah.
And I just think you're getting nothing back. No one can see your smile. Why are you bothering? Eventually they'll stop bothering, because you don't get that signal. There's nothing. Your brain isn't receiving any gratification from doing it. So they'll stop smiling in public. Then they'll stop smiling when they're not wearing a mask as well. People will stop smiling at their wives, at their husbands, at their children, at their siblings. The smile could potentially just die out as a physical thing that we do. Well, that's massive. That's a huge, huge thing to lose.
Well,
incredibly dangerous.
It's coming everywhere. I mean, look at sort of modern comedy on the television. No one's smiling at that.
Yeah.
They're cheering on the rhetoric.
Interestingly, one of the people often say about Peter Hitchens that he never smiles. And he's very, very proud to admit that he doesn't smile very much. And why should he? It's up to him. But I would say again, you know, I don't want everybody to walk around like some ecstatic lunatic, smiling and grinning their way through life. I think we need some pessimists and some cynical people in society. You know, we need a few Eeyores in our lives. It's crucial, though, that we can still see their faces and tell that that's what they look like and that's what they are projecting to the world. I'm not a massively social person. You know, I'm quite happy staying at home, doing my drawings and looking after my pigs. I'm not sort of arguing all of this because I desperately want to go to a nightclub again. You know, it's more of a general feeling about the society I want to live in. And I want my children to have the opportunity to grow up in.
Well, that moves me into something that's quite definitely worth talking about. And I feel that one of the things that excises me about all of this is was the birth of my son, and how he's basically lived. So he was born in December, so he's basically lived most of his life in this hell.
Yeah.
And it really strikes me actually how he's not aware of it, you know, how he doesn't. I can't explain to him yet what everything is, and it would be interesting to, if this does go on for years, I can imagine explaining to him. There used to be these things called pubs, and we used to go to gigs, and there used to be live. You know, you go into this crowded room, and a man would get an instrument out, and he'd play it, and everyone would move their bodies towards it. You know, and you'd touch people and sometimes put your arm around people you didn't even know.
Yes.
You know?
There used to be these things called handshakes.
There used to be the things called handshakes. To be honest, actually, I'm back in like hugging and handshaking mode. And if anyone's got a problem with that, go fuck yourself, because that's
well. Don't you find there is nothing more rewarding and satisfying these days when you meet up with a friend you haven't seen since the beginning of this, and they go in for a hug because you know, and you've been worried for days that they're going to try and do some weird elbow bump or something with you.
I hug new people now, you know, because I've met people through doing this. I've met them in person. I've met people in shout outs to the Third Wednesday group. And it's hugs all round, you know, and because that's the way I am. I like that, and that's that. But sorry, I sort of digress a little bit there. But and I feel very strongly when I see your cartoons that I think that your children guide you. I think that they're always at the back of your mind, in the same way that my son's at the back of mine, and it's interesting. So this idea of the moral philosophy and the moral framework in which we raise our children. Mm. And I know that's something that that concerns you. So I'll mention, so for me, everything wheedles its way back to Orwell in some way. And I don't mean this kind of basic reference to security cameras or Orwellian or whatever, or the kind of memes. But I mean, I'm a huge fan of his writing, and his collected essays are just wonderful. So for instance, my opposition to the death penalty comes from his description of watching a man being hanged when he was a policeman in Burma, and that really affected me. And he wrote about how when the man stepped off outside a puddle, and he just realised that it was that the reflex action to protect his feet from getting wet, that comes from a whole world, and that whole world was going to be gone in 10 minutes. And I could never support capital punishment after reading that. And there's so much of that in his writing. And one of my favourite essays is called Why I Write, where he writes about how his writing has this kind of political and moralistic drive. So, it's a very long question, but Bob, why do you draw?
Well, you're right in that I think my perspective on what I do and my motivation has shifted massively since I became a parent. As I said, from a young age, my motivation was just to try and make people laugh with what I was drawing. And when I started working as a political cartoonist, the thing that I needed to work on was knowing what to say as well as, you know, I quickly realized it's not enough just to make somebody laugh with this. You've got to actually say something. When I first started working at the Telegraph, I was only 25, and I'm happy to admit I really wasn't ready. I still had a lot to learn, but I was able to kind of learn on the job, and I had a really good comment editor when I started there called Chris Deering, who was quite harsh with me. He would deliberately, I think, reject a lot of my ideas just because he wanted me to come up with as many as possible. But his catchphrase was, he was Scottish, and he would say, "Yeah, it's really funny, but what's it saying? Well, you're not saying anything. Come on, what's it trying to say?" You know, always he would say that. What's it trying to say? And I still have his voice in my head now whenever I'm working, because it's the key thing.
Yeah.
But I think a big change happened when my daughter was born, and very difficult time. She was extremely ill. She was brain damaged at birth, and she had to be in intensive care for nearly 2 weeks.
Oh my, I can't even begin to imagine what that must have been like.
And it was becoming a parent changes you anyway. Becoming a parent in those circumstances totally changes your perspective on everything. And it caused me to really reflect on my work and my role. And I mean, I found it very difficult to cope with my own sense of guilt about what happened. Still do to an extent.
Why would you feel guilty?
A sense that I could have done more.
Right.
That I could have, you know, when they refused to allow us to see a doctor, rather than being British and polite about it or trusting that the NHS was in any way competent, I should have run down the corridor, you know, smashing the place up until the doctor arrived. I don't think I'll ever shed a sense of guilt and shame, but I remember this overriding feeling of, you know, you suddenly find yourself in this neonatal intensive care unit, which is one of the most extraordinary places you can ever be, one of the most humbling places, and you know, the one aspect of the NHS which I find infinitely impressive, just astonishing, you know, and almost everything else that I've experienced of it has been dire, and it was the NHS that put my daughter in that situation in the first place. But
really?
Anyway, I remember being there and just sort of surrounded by these amazing doctors and nurses who were putting all of their knowledge and years of training into trying to help my little girl to survive, you know, and her chances of survival were at best 50-50 at that time. Thinking, I draw pictures for a living. I've spent all of my life practicing drawing cartoons of people's faces. What use is that to me now? You know, it really made me stop and think about, you know, what am I actually using this talent, if you can call it that, for? What difference am I able to make? And so anyway, a couple of years after, a colleague at work persuaded me to create a kind of animated video about the birth of my daughter and what had happened and my experience of becoming a dad, which I agreed to reluctantly at first, and took me a long time because it was partly kind of therapy working on this and drawing. In drawing about the experience, I sort of discovered things about the way I felt about it I hadn't really confronted before. And this, I think it was 5, maybe 6 years ago that was released, had a very big impact, and, you know, several million people seen it and got a lot of amazing messages from other parents who've been through the same thing. And, you know, it was the first time I felt I'd made a genuine difference with my art. And I think I realized then that I was good at making people laugh, but I also, I think, had a knack for weaving emotion into the humor and the cartooning. And that's definitely something I have employed to a great extent this year in a lot of my work, and trying to get across that raw emotion that's involved in what's going on, and these aspects of families being torn apart and the things that really matter to us. I don't think I'd be able to engage that aspect of my talent if I wasn't a parent and if I hadn't been through that in becoming a parent. It fundamentally changed my mentality and my approach to the whole creative process, I think.
And do you think that's made you think more about morality?
Yes. I mean, going through something like that, you are forced to confront all of these difficult questions about life and death, about the value of life, about the morality of, you know, how how much is it okay to sacrifice to, you know, to protect, to what extent should suffering be endured to prevent death, either your own or someone else's? And to what extent should life be sacrificed in order to prevent suffering? You know, all these massive questions, questions that people like Robert Peston and Laura Koonsberg and Beth Rigby should have been asking the Prime Minister from March, and none of them have. You know, no one is interested in these questions. And I think it's, yes, you're right. You think very deeply about these moral questions. And what it also meant right from the start was that what we as parents absolutely did not want was for our daughter to feel afraid or vulnerable or special in the sense that she wasn't able to do what other children could do. It's not been easy, because the older she's become, the more apparent it is to her that she's different and there are things that other children do that she's not able to. But I think that there are lots of reasons she could be afraid. There are lots of ways in which she is at very high risk compared to other children. She has cerebral palsy. She also has epilepsy, so she can have very severe seizures. And they always happen at night. Every time she goes to bed at night, there's a risk that she could be seriously, even fatally ill. Several times she's had to be rushed to hospital because they could, you know, these seizures went on for an hour and they couldn't stop them and things.
Jesus Christ.
And that gives me a perspective in terms of, I mean, I hope that no other parent, I know a lot of other parents do endure that kind of horror, but I'm very glad most parents never have to face that kind of horror. But once you go through something like that, once you've been confronted, you know, several times with the reality that your child may be about to die, it does give you a perspective on risks to children. And it does make you slightly annoyed that children are now being told that if they sing happy birthday in their classroom, somebody might die. You know?
Yeah.
It's... And being made to wash their hands 25 times a day and being made to feel like any dirt will kill them or somebody else or their grandmother. And you think, no, this is not a healthy way to deal with children.
And it's funny because I think what's happening as well is we're scaring children about issues of mortality in a way that A is completely unsuitable for them anyway. And that very early on, there was a fear that they would serve as vectors for the disease. And, you know, there's cases of pubs, you know, when they are open, banning children because children will run around and, you know, the most wonderful thing, children running around and the people, oh no, they'll spread death with them. And at the same time, I feel like the sort of political educational culture of this country and has become more juvenile, and that we are much less able to discuss these things. So I'm not religious at all, but going to church every Sunday provided for people a space to think about these issues of life and death and morality and all this.
Yeah.
And now that doesn't exist anymore. And in many ways, it exists, but it's, you know, Peter Hitchens would have something to say about it. But people don't go the way they did. But in many ways, sort of television has kind of overtaken that role in teaching our children about ethics.
Yes.
And in some ways, I think that's very possible. So what a wonderful thing anybody can have a look at is the episode of Sesame Street where one of the cast members died, And the writers, rather than just ignoring it, decide to write it into the script. And Big Bird plays the role of the child. And he and the rest of the cast have to explain to him, I think it was the shopkeeper. And Big Bird can't accept that he's just got, he thinks that he's going to come back again, and like he's just away for the day or something.
I think I remember that, yes. Yeah. Sesame Street was just incredible.
Oh, it was so good.
There is nothing, there's never been anything like it since. And like you say, it had that wonderful ability to be wacky and funny and educational and occasionally tap into these really deep moral sensitive issues in a way that children could get their heads around. I think, have you ever been religious or?
I mean, when I was like 10, you know, in the way that we all had to sort of do the Lord's Prayer and sing a hymn and all that. But yeah, I fell out of it. And then as an undergraduate, I moved into the kind of more hippy dippy kind of, group consciousness man kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's
Christopher Hitchens as opposed to Peter.
Yes. Yeah. it's well, funny. So go on.
Well, because it's maybe quite interesting in that I was very religious. I was sort of grew up, you know, we would go to church. You know, my earliest memories are of walking down to our village church with my father. And he was on the parish council, and he would often do, I can remember him doing a reading in the service. I would only have been 3 or 4, and I remember feeling really proud of him when he got up to do the reading in church. And it was a tiny village church in a sort of southwest countryside, and there would be sort of a few farmers and some wealthy landlords in tweed suits. And
Did you grow up in a Jane Austen novel?
It was it was very much like that, you know. And it was a lovely, beautiful old church, and it had that quiet dignity of Middle England Church of England kind of services. And it was all very personal. It was all very private and reflective. Mm. I think part of what happened was I got to university and discovered this entirely different type of Christianity that was more like going to a pop concert where Jesus was kind of like some sort of rock star
that
people gyrated and whooped and hollered and clapped for. And I thought, that's not what I understood the value of religion to be.
I just want to tell you about my mate, man, and my mate is Jesus.
Yes, all that sort of thing. And over a few years, I simply lost my ability to believe. And there are times, and certainly been times, as you know, for example, the birth of my daughter, when I caught myself wishing I still had it. Mm. But I'm of the view that you either believe something or you don't. You can't force yourself to. This year, though, I have really reflected on how much of that moral grounding I got from those first 20 years or so of religious belief. Mm-hmm. And I fully acknowledge that it's not the only place you can get moral education from. I think religion doesn't necessarily provide the moral lessons we need, but what it does do is create a space in which we're all comfortable talking about those issues.
Do you think Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say that I think that, you know, for years, people have, I think, rightly been asking, what is the church actually for? What is the role of these religious leaders? This year, they've had their best opportunity for a long time to actually come forward and say, hey, guys, this is what we're for. We've spent our whole lives thinking about these kind of issues. Here's why it's not morally justified to do this. And they've been silent.
They've been terrible. I think, actually, you did do a cartoon with Justin Welby.
Justin Welby, yes, I did, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so this is, I think there's him just sitting on next to a phone doing nothing. And then finally in September, he says, Prime Minister, I'm worried about your moral philosophy.
Yeah, he'd finally come out and said something that was incredibly tame. And I just thought, how pathetic. You wait all of this time and then just say something completely nebulous and grey.
I think he's terrible. I think he's... I believe that... this is probably a source of one of our ills, is the fact that so many of our public institutions and our established institutions are run by these kind of grey, managerial, non-entity, rubbish people. Like, they have no flair. They're good at meetings. You know, they're good at rising up, and they all have this kind of completely boring blancmange of a political philosophy that's immediately identifiable, and it is, you know, it's sort of misunderstand our priorities. And, you know, that's why the National Trust and the police and the church and, you know, even now the army apparently is all, it's all in the state that it is.
It seems that all of exactly the wrong types of people go into these roles.
Yes.
Every time.
Yeah, they should be shut away, you know, teaching. It's that they say, someone famously said, in a parallel universe, Theresa May is in the Middling Public School as a head of geography. And that's what she should have been doing. And the same thing, Chris is a dick. And I mean, it's an interesting one as well, because it kind of... Chris is a dick, I always like to come back to as one of these completely promoted above a station people, because she was the gold commander when Jean-Charles de Menezes was killed.
Mm.
And that was a really good example of panic taking a life, because the police leaked all this stuff about how he ran away from the police and he vaulted over the barrier, and it was all lies. And at the end of the day, he left his house, they ran after him, and they pumped him full of about 10 rounds in his head. And he was doing nothing. But it's amazing, he was just walking along, but all around him was this crazy surveillance that just got something wrong. And I feel it's a really good... And now she's in charge of the police as opposed to being fired. How the fuck did that happen, by the way? And it's a very good example about how... where we are, where we are. You know, these people are completely ill-prepared to deal with anything different or new, and they're just liable to panic.
Well, and also perhaps the common denominator amongst these people may be... this is exactly what institutions are looking for, is their totally relaxed attitude towards never ever admitting they've made a terrible mistake.
Mm.
Never ever being able to come forward and say, we got that completely wrong. I promise it won't happen again.
Which is something that is taught in as a moral thing that we're not taught anymore.
Yes, but we have this weird thing going on, don't we, around apologising and forgiving. That, but way before any of this virus stuff happened or anything else, and I think it comes from social media to a large extent, there's a reluctance to apologise for anything, and you even see it with, if you're dealing with any kind of... shop or business or bank or whatever it is that have made a mistake, you will hardly ever hear the word sorry. They have these weird semantic vocal ways of skirting around an apology that mean they never actually have to say sorry. I think you realise that these people are trained never to say the word sorry to a customer. And then you have the other side of it, which is that if somebody ever does admit that they've done something wrong and say sorry, no one is willing to forgive them. No one is willing to draw a line under it. There's no forgiveness. Douglas Murray talks about this all the time. We've lost our ability to forgive, which again probably comes back to that loss of religion, because that was something else that it provided a space for people to actually contemplate the importance of forgiveness, and we've lost it. And that is... it's a major problem. And I think, you know, I say when people are asking me, how did we get here? How did this all of this actually happen? I always come back to social media, and I often say, I honestly don't think we would have been able to get into this situation 15, 20 years ago. It is only because we have social media and it's reached the size and it has the kind of influence that it does today, that something like this is able to happen. You know, and if I had my way, I'd resolve this whole situation and then immediately shut down social media for good. And I'd say, that was an experiment that went horribly wrong. We should never do it again. You know, lesson learned.
Well,
but I think I said to you when you first asked me about doing this podcast, how reluctant I've been in the past to engage very much with social media. You know, I never used to tweet. Precisely, I would just put my cartoons out there and that was it. Precisely because I thought social media is a sewer, you know, Twitter is awful. It only makes things worse. And only something like 15% of the population are on it. You know, it's not the real world. But increasingly, particularly this year, it's influenced everything. You think, well, and I think my view was, if what happens on social media is going to dictate everything about the way we live our lives, then let's make it the battleground. And let's have this fight on there as much as anywhere else.
I do worry, though, that I get too aggressive on it because I'm so angry. Do you?
Yes. Yes, I do. Yes, it's very important to temper yourself and hesitate. And I think somebody, a close friend, said that, actually I think it was my sister-in-law, said this to me the other day, that so often in a situation like this where you're furious and you're angry and you're desperately trying to make people understand, it can be a lot more effective to just throw something positive out. And there are so many aspects of this that are just entirely positive and morally unarguable, you would think. And so if you throw something back, like, for example, my picture of Never Surrender Your Right to Be With the People You Love.
It's one of my favourite pictures ever.
I almost didn't do it because I thought, this is unnecessary. You know, everybody knows this is such an obvious statement. And so many people argue with it, and it's such a controversial... I thought, in 2020, that has become a controversial statement. But you think, that's actually a good way of fighting this. You force your opponents to make themselves look ridiculous by arguing with something like that and saying, well, actually, no, I don't think that is a right people have. You know? You think that's how you'll lose this.
Yeah.
By being forced to take those kind of positions.
Because I feel, this is one of the reasons I wanted to get you on as well, was the science alone won't win this. You know, this is a cultural fight, and I feel that, I mean, I'm certainly going to up the ante. So if anybody's listening with bated breath, I actually filmed Mike Yaden last week in a really high-end way, and I'm going to put that out. I'm going to start filming some more of my former guests as well, because I feel that podcasts are great. I really love them. I love the medium, and that's why I started it. But in order to have that reach, then you need to sort of go beyond that. And you need, you know, there's film, there's video, and in your case, there's cartoons, and I think they're remarkably powerful. You know, there's a reason why they use them in the propaganda posters in the war, isn't there?
I think. Obviously I already had an appreciation for the power of the image, but this year has really brought it home to me how much weight you can carry with an image if you think of the right one, if you say the right thing with it. It can carry immense power. I think that Mike Yaden is... interesting in the sense that he is very, very scientific, but he will often talk about the moral side of things, and he's clearly very distressed by that, the injustice there, which you don't hear a lot from scientists. I said to somebody right near the beginning, only a couple of months in, I was having an argument with some friends about masks, I think, both of whom were scientists, and you know, I was trying to explain to them that, look, we're not going to agree on this, and I realise why. It's because my mind works in a completely different way. You're scientists, and you're concerned with, you're so focused on these numbers and the, you know, what a virus does or doesn't do, and you're not able to think about the things that I'm concerned about, which is more societal and you know, the moral issues. And I said, no scientist could change my mind now. My mind could only really be changed if you presented me with kind of 10 professors of philosophy and history and human, you know, some kind of deep moral thinkers who'd spent their whole lives thinking about this, who said, no, you've got this wrong, Bob. Actually, it's entirely right what they're doing. And everything you've thought up until now about good and evil in your life has been a mistake. You were wrong. You know, and actually this is that's what it would take to convince me.
But even so, there's so many different philosophers. I mean,
it's
your philosophy.
They never agree.
Yeah, you get two in a room, you get three opinions, as they say.
Yeah. Same with scientists, though.
Yes. I mean, and that's, again, the whole thing I find annoying about this. I mean, I'm sure you get it as well. You know, people going, you know, what's your PhD in? And
oh, yes, I've been reminded several times, as I'm sure you have, that I'm not, in fact, an epidemiologist. Yeah. And I've always found that incredibly dangerous, this idea that unless you are a scientist, not just a scientist even, but an expert in this particular field of science, you have no right to contribute anything to the discussion. You're not entitled to a view. And there are so many people that I know, you know, people I've known for a long time who I know are very clever, very decent, very moral people who have taken this view that because I'm not a scientific expert, I'm just going to sit back and let all of this disaster wash over me. Mm. I'm just going to do exactly what I'm told because I have no right to an opinion on it. Because I don't understand how viruses spread. And you think, that is bizarre. I mean, Peter Hitchens, keep coming back to Peter Hitchens, but he's a great man. He's been right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Uses this analogy of Boris Johnson finding he has a wasp's nest in his house and deciding to burn his house down in order to deal with the wasp's nest. which is a great analogy, but this attitude of, well, you're not a scientist, is a bit like somebody telling you they're going to do that, and you saying, I don't think that's a good idea, and they reply, oh, I didn't realise you were a world-leading expert in fires.
Well,
how can you possibly know the house will burn down?
You had a really good analogy that you put on Twitter, I think. You should do it as a cartoon, I'd love to see it. You said
the shark tank.
Yeah, the shark tank. Do you want to explain the shark tank?
That's a similar idea. Oh, well, it was this interesting moral thought experiment that actually my brother, I have to credit my brother with coming up with. I'm sure similar things have existed before, but in one of our long phone calls, this came up where you have a 90-year-old man and a 5-year-old boy suspended over shark tanks. And I can't remember how I put it on Twitter. I don't know. I think the best way to say it is that you can save one of them. So, and the other one will be released into the shark tank, and you have to choose which one you're going to save. And everybody knows what choice they would make instinctively in that situation. Mm. You don't need to know exactly why you would do it, although there is an interesting process and equation that we do use and is the basis, in fact, for our entire health system. But anyway,
the qualies and all that. But
yes,
yeah. but we don't even need to go there because it's.
You don't even need to get into that because the point yeah. is, you don't need to be an expert in the feeding habits of sharks to make your decision.
I know, and it's constant, and now. And that, now there's a thing that I've discovered on Twitter of people pretending to be doctors and virologists, which is coming out. And actually, some very politicised ones, you know, who are doctors, but just making stuff up. And it's just completely degraded the public discourse. And it just kind of, God, you know, after Brexit, I thought, you know, we were all like, oh, finally, right, let's move on. And now we're just dragged into this, you know, it's like you were in a sort of like little battle in the 1930s from some small war, and then you came out of that and thought, oh, thank God. And then, whap, you're hit with a world war. And you thought, oh, no, I'm back in this conflict. And it's interesting, social media, I think, forces people into those two sides. And the argument you said earlier, we wouldn't have been through this 15, 20 years ago. I 100% agree. I think 15, 20 years ago, we would be sitting around saying, God, the flu was really bad this year, wasn't it? It's very nasty.
Yeah, that's well, yeah. It's interesting you say that because I don't know how much longer you want to talk for, but just another thing I wanted to touch on was exactly that idea. The fact that it is so easy to imagine all of this not really being an event at all.
Mm.
The whole thing. Unfolding something like this, where we were aware that this thing was going on in China and that it had left China and it was beginning to spread around the world. And for a few days, it's in the news and it's announced that the virus that's spreading from China is a type of coronavirus. So coronaviruses include the common cold, and they're things that we all live with for a long time. It's thought to affect people in a similar way to influenza. It spreads a bit more aggressively. We're not sure if it requires slightly different treatment, but the NHS have been told to brace for the equivalent of a bad flu season.
Mm.
And that would be it. And what would have happened then was people would have forgotten about it and got on with their lives as normal, and like me, like you, like everyone I know, they would not have had any first-hand contact, the majority of people, with this thing going on. They wouldn't have been aware of it. Maybe in the middle, sometime in May or June, there'd have been another little report saying, oh, the NHS has struggled a bit to cope with, you know, ICUs have been quite full with very old, very sick people, and they're also contending with this coronavirus.
Mm.
And then around this time, there would be a couple of headlines in a couple of papers saying 50,000 people thought to have died, 50,000 elderly, vulnerable people thought to have died from COVID-19. And you'd have read the article, it would have said something like, as a result, NHS braces for very quiet flu season.
Yeah. You know? Yes.
And some people would have read that. They wouldn't have paid much attention to it. And again, they'd have gone on with their normal lives. What I can guarantee no sane person would have done when they read that, thrown their arms in the air and declared, why on earth didn't the government shut down the entire economy? Why didn't they lock us in our houses? Why didn't we destroy children's education? Why didn't we take away all of our basic civil liberties? Why didn't we insist that the entire population lived in permanent fear in the vain hope that we might have stopped some of these people dying? No one would have reacted like that.
No.
Because the fact is, this what's played out could have potentially have been done in any bad flu year. They could have declared the same emergency. They could have thrown up all of the same graphs. They could have done all the same testing and probably got even more frightening amount of cases. Because as I understand it, the only time they actually tested in this way for influenza before was during one of the other outbreaks. And they were getting something like 8,000 cases a day for influenza. You know, it's not... it all could have happened before.
I love those counterfactuals because imagine, so 2 or 3 years ago, you go to the GP and say, "Doctor, I've got this terrible virus. I need to get tested." Okay, what are your symptoms? Well, nothing. Have you been ill?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But I'm terrified. I might kill my grandmother.
Yes, exactly.
They put you in they commit you probably rather than giving you a test. And you know, it's. I think Professor Francois Ballou said it best with these things, because this idea, no one would demand this, and now they're demanding more and more. And he said, "Look, we're like children on a beach, and you think that we're pushing in and out the waves as they lap on the shore,
yes.
and we think that we're in control and we're doing it, and you know, and now." And even amongst quite sane people who are on the lockdown skeptic side, there's this acknowledgement that sort of lockdowns work, and they say, "Oh yeah, they will push down." You know, the 2 week circuit. If you say that a 2 week circuit breaker will just be enough to stop virus transmission, you are a fucking idiot.
You know? Well, this is a slight digression, maybe, but it's relevant. Have you ever seen? My favourite Derren Brown experiment is the one where he puts, I think they're sort of celebrities maybe, he puts a bunch of people in a room, and there are lots and lots of different objects and sort of puzzles and coloured items and things in this room. Right. And they're locked in the room, and on the wall in front of them is a counter with numbers that every so often go up. Mm. And they're told that if they can figure out what it is they're doing that's making, what it is that's happening, what they're doing, that is making those numbers go up, and they can get the number up to a certain amount, they win, I don't know what it is, £250,000. And they'll be let out of the room. And they instantly start this frenzied experimenting with all these different objects, and then they start thinking about where they're standing and what they're doing and what they're saying and all of these things, and all the time these numbers are going up, and eventually they run out of time, and Derren Brown comes in and says to them, so one of the objects in the room is a goldfish tank, and there's just a laser running through the centre of the goldfish tank, and every time the fish swims through the centre, the number changes. That's all. And then he says, "Turn around." This is the best bit. On the wall behind them, which none of them have looked at, is written, "The door's unlocked. If you leave, you can all have the money." And I think that's such a great analogy for what's going on now.
The doors are unlocked. And yet, guys, if we can leave, we can all have the money. Yeah. Well, we can't. Actually, in a way, it's almost like we can't, because the damage done is so great that we can't have money anymore. But actually, Well, that leads me on to my final thing I like to ask you. So I came to this realization recently, because at the beginning of this, Peter Hitchens was like the only voice saying no. Maybe Brendan O'Neill. He was definitely against closing the pubs. But now there's a lot more resistance. You know, they're really doing it in some cases, like Manchester, they're doing it in the teeth of local resistance. But and so what I realised is that the spectrum of lockdown scepticism and lockdown zealotry is a one-way street. Right?
Yes.
People move from zealotry to scepticism, or tacit acceptance to resistance, or whatever you want to call it, but they move from one side to the other, but never
they don't
back.
Go back.
No way. So every day, and the more that we put stuff out, the more cartoons you do, all helps. But I mean, I kind of think Maureen from Barnsley has done more for the cause than any of them.
Yes, you might be right.
But every day we go stronger, and they grow weaker, you know. So there is, my hope is there, but I'm still petrified for two reasons. That speaking to Mike Yaden, and I've got Claire Craig coming up on the podcast later as well, and they're both, their contentions are very much that it's the ramping up of the testing, which shows no sign of abating, is keeping us in this because of the false positive phenomenon. And that even counts for deaths as well.
Yes.
But no need to go into the science of that here. That'll be for another day. And secondly, these voices saying new normal for years. So bear in mind these things. Where do you see this happening, going rather? Where do you see us in a year or two?
It's a very difficult question.
I just asked you to predict the future. So.
Yes, well, there's a big difference between what I hope and what I suspect might be the case. I mean, I think you're right that there are more and more people all the time coming onto our side, and it's very true that nobody ever kind of wakes up to how mad all of this is, and then a few days later watches the news and puts their mask back on and decides to abide by all the rules. It doesn't happen that way, because it's quite a complicated psychological phenomenon. I think this it is like being in a cult. You know, it is convincing yourself that you're doing something for the greater good that's incredibly compassionate and kind and worthwhile, and you must believe all of this. These things, even in the face of mounting evidence that it's a complete waste of time, the instinct is to dig in your heels and cover your ears and, you know, and just refuse to listen. But once you break free of that, there is no going back. But I think Hitchens makes this point as well, that to an extent, no matter how many people join our side, it only changes when the government change their attitude. Because everyone in the country could be against it. If the government still have these emergency powers in place, they can still do what they want. That's the major issue. And I think it would be very different if we had an opposition that was actually opposing any of this. You could see it all coming apart a lot more easily. I mean, it's just incredible that there hasn't been a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister. I mean, Keir Starmer has not really disagreed with a single thing that's been done. You find yourself in this extraordinary situation of wondering whether Jeremy Corbyn would have, and you think, I think he might have done. It's possible. And so it's very difficult to see how it resolves itself. I mean, I don't know. I was having a discussion with somebody, a colleague at work the other day, who I was thinking of doing something on what the Conservatives are currently doing to the North, having, supposedly borrowed all of these votes from Northerners to win the last election. And now they're just totally ruining everything, wrecking their lives and taking their jobs away and destroying everything up there. I said, well, those votes aren't coming back, are they? You know, this is, they've thrown those away. And he said, oh, well, you know, there's no evidence at the moment that people are turning against the Conservative Party. We don't know that they're losing votes. And I just thought, how extraordinary, what an extraordinary thing to say. I mean, I can't imagine people voting for the Conservatives for another 100 years after this. Well, I don't even know if they're... I mean, I don't see why the party should be allowed to even survive after what they will have done to the country.
But you say that, but look at the polling. I mean, the Tories are still a few points ahead. Every party is tainted by this. I mean, you know, to give the Conservative Party the smallest bit of credit, the only MPs who are saying anything about this are Tory.
That's true.
The only ones voting against...
Yeah.
You know, Charles Walker is the only one to vote against this idea of forcibly forcing people into isolation, which is profoundly wrong.
Amazing that only
one person.
I know.
And do none of these people ever think to themselves, because the war on terror and that sort of legislative disaster and the disasters of the wars isn't that long ago. And we know now that that was used to justify all sorts of awful policies and all sorts of awful laws and all sorts of awful wars. And no one ever thinks, God, you know, isn't this stuff that we're sort of pushing in now, might it have consequences down the road? Might it be used for other stuff? Like, just no, doesn't enter.
Well, I suppose that a key difference is important, and it's very easy to forget this. Even I catch myself forgetting it sometimes. Is that this isn't just happening in Britain. You know, this is not the same as, this isn't Brexit or anything like that. This is happening all over the world. It's not just our government that's behaving in this way. So that's one thing. I mean, I think that what happened at the beginning, possibly, is the media decided to engage in a kind of game with governments all over the world and started to use this as a way of playing them off against each other. I mean, our media did that here for 3 years with Brexit. You know, it was a game. You play both sides off constantly. With this, it was almost as soon as the first graph appeared anywhere, it became, politicians were invited to engage in this game with very clear rules. And it was kind of, here are your strategies you can choose from. You know, lockdown is one, masks is one, protecting the vulnerable is one, doing nothing is one. Mm-hmm. You can choose your strategy and you get points the lower your COVID deaths are. And no other deaths count. You don't get. We're not going interested in that. It's just how low can you make these deaths? And what it meant for politicians was, here was an opportunity every day to stand up and saying, "Look how well we're doing. Mm. We're making some kind of progress. We're actually taking action, and we've got some numbers, some graphs to prove that that is good. You know, we're having some success." Immediately the questions came in, oh, they're locking down already. When are you going to lock down? Do you think you should have locked down already? How many deaths are you estimating? What if Neil Ferguson is being, really, he's got it wrong and it's actually 2 million people? All of these things. But I think, crucially, both sides, the media and the politicians, understood that it was an unwinnable game long term. No one could win. But that didn't matter, because in the short term, they both benefited. I think they realised too late that they couldn't just walk away from the board. I think there was an assumption that in a few weeks' time, people will lose interest in this, it will peter out, some other story will come along, and we can forget about it. And perhaps they just got stuck playing this game, and they don't know how to stop.
Yes. And
it's escalated beyond that into something completely different. That's one theory. I mean, I don't know. As time goes on, I'm less convinced. I wonder if other things have come in and taken advantage of the situation.
Oh, that certainly is happening. You know, I don't believe. I get sent messages all the time and videos about, you know, the Great World Order planning all of this in order to put microchips in us or whatever. But there are bad actors, and yeah, the one conspiracy that I do lean towards is the nefarious world of People's Republic of China and all of this. And the reason I have no problem believing that they would do that is because they have concentration camps in the 21st century. So I have no doubt that they're completely morally bankrupt.
Yes, but, I mean, I don't think there's anything conspiratorial in simply acknowledging the fact that what has happened in the Western world this year is China's dream.
Yeah.
They have, whether they instigated it or not, they now find themselves in a situation where everything, the crucial things that separated us from them about our values and the way we lived and the way our systems, political systems worked, have been thrown down the drain.
Yeah.
And we're now all living in China's world.
Yeah. We are.
They're the ones who invented this way of living.
the Hong Kong health and security policy, which we are now all stuck in.
Yes.
Which is, yeah, it's. I mean, look at what's happening in you know, it started, obviously there was the lockdown, but then it started popping up again. Scottish universities was one. Now it's all of Wales, where they're checking people's, you know, to see where they've come in from, you know, not letting them buy books. Books.
Yes.
I feel, Bob, that we could just go on and on and on and on, you know. And
I think we could. It's so incredibly therapeutic to be able to talk to somebody who feels the same way, isn't it?
Really?
So,
I thought you.
Yes.
Oh, that's so nice. Oh, well, that's why I do these, really. It's to provide a space where, you know, we can all talk. And obviously, there are many people doing similar. You know, there's obviously my Obi-Wan, James Dellingpole, you know, who his podcast is great.
I've agreed to do James's podcast as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad that I nipped in there just before
he gave us his blessing.
He did. Yes. He's my Obi-Wan. You know, I said this to James. I see this podcast as almost like a child of his one. But yes. I very deliberately wanted to focus just on the lockdown. And it's been great as well because early on I was worried about, and I still get, I would sometimes get worried about how, oh, you know, will I have enough people to talk about? And every time we go on, I just find more and more people that I'm interested to talk to. And what's really surprising about it is how very rarely does anybody turn me down. It's odd. People just really want to talk about this stuff. And it's absolutely terrific. But as I said, I do want to go back into film and video, because I just feel that it would have a bigger spread and would have a bigger impact. And I call Maureen from Barnsley a crossover hit, right? And we definitely need
more Maureens.
We need more crossover hits.
Yeah. It's I think, well, perhaps just to finish on a positive note, along those lines, is that something that's interested me is this is such a huge event. You know, this is not, people are constantly trying to downplay it, like you say, oh, it's only temporary, it'll be over soon or whatever. It's the most historically significant thing that's happened in our lifetimes, for sure,
by miles.
And it isn't in any way comparable to something like Brexit, you know, where people argued over it, it divided lots of people and it ended friendships because, you know, you just had a different view. The key difference for something like that was it was all speculation. It was something that was going to happen, you know, and people were saying, oh, this will be the outcome. And then the other side was saying this, no, you're wrong. We've lived through this. It's been happening in real time in front of us. And so where people stand is a lot more significant. And I think it's so profoundly moral and important, and it taps into all of these things we've been talking about, you know, how you value life, how you want to raise your children, how you balance life and death and sanctity of life and quality of life and all this stuff, that when you find somebody who agrees with you on what's happening to do with this virus, you find yourself thinking, I genuinely don't care what your opinions are about anything else.
Yeah.
I don't care how you voted in Brexit. I don't care whether you're left or right wing. I don't care what music you like listening to, or whether you're a vegan or anything. I know you're a good egg because of your view on this. I just know you're a decent human being. And that's actually a lovely, a very valuable thing to have. It's quite rare that something comes up like this. And I think many great friendships, a lot of solidarity and goodwill will be forged.
Oh God. I mean, I've made so many friends doing this. And you know, even a lot of my podcast guests, it started off as like just an email or a Twitter DM. I still talk to them all the time, you know, and we're, you know, just about what we can do and you know what we're up to. And I think it's such a wonderful thing, and I'm really proud of some of them as well, you know, for what they've gone on to do. So Matt Strauss over in Canada, he was one of the first signatories to the Barrington Declaration.
Right,
and
yes.
I feel like, oh yeah, you know, I feel like protective of him, like he's some like band that like I got into before anyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
and so that's my hope, and you know, I'm always trying to identify mistakes that the Remain campaign made, and how we can sort of not make them. Although we have a much harder challenge in many ways, because the Remain campaign had sort of Parliament on side and all world government, and, you know, we don't. But you know, still, these.
There's another key difference with that, though, with Brexit, I think, which is that there is a very strong argument, there always has been with Brexit, that I find so often concludes any sensible and intelligent debates you have with people over it, is that perhaps in reality we should never ever have been asked, and that most people didn't actually want to be asked the question, and they didn't really feel properly qualified. Right. However passionate they were one way or the other, there is an argument, I think, for that, did we really even need to have a referendum at all? Mm. And this situation is the opposite.
We
should have been asked.
We're not asked.
And we should never ever let something like this happen again without being asked.
But Bob, the problem is that, you know as well as I do, that very early on, if they'd have asked, the people would have said a resounding yes, let's do this.
Based on what we were being told. Yeah.
We're being told. Yeah. And then I know now that one of my compadres in Third Wednesday shared some polling she got from YouGov to take part, to be polled. And the questions are so leading, it's absurd. It literally says some people think of herd immunity, but most scientists think that this would be a disaster. You know, it literally says that in the polling. So in terms of warping things, and I was polled once, I think I mentioned this before, but you're really constrained by what you can say. So
you're the first person I've ever met who's actually been polled.
It's nuts. They called me up.
I'm seeing you as some sort of unicorn now.
Yeah, they do. What I'd love to meet one day is somebody who was in that family fortune survey. So, you know, someone...
Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah. Our survey says,
They asked 100 people, and that show was on for years. Surely you'd meet one occasionally who were like, you know, oh, yeah, so what do you think of... What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of Henry VIII?
They kept them all locked in a warehouse somewhere.
Maybe it was the first case of public manipulative polling. You know that Peter Hitchens thing of opinion polls are for influencing rather than measuring public opinion. Maybe Family Fortunes was the beginning of that, and it was all
the polls being published at the moment are extraordinary. The amount of people who apparently support everything that's going on. Who on earth are you asking?
Would you ever listen to the radio or watch television?
Yes, exactly.
Just, oh my god, you live like the BBC radio. All my radios used to be Radio 4 machines. That was, I prefer speech, especially when driving, even though I love music. But for radio, I prefer speech, and I now I can't bear to have it on at all. Even if it's not news, you know, because it all creeps in there. And thank God, you know, podcasts have come along, and you know, this one, I don't get any money for this. Costs me money to do. I get nothing out of it apart from the satisfaction of making it, and I think that's the same for most podcasts. And yet, it's so much better than Radio 4 ever was. Really, the whole podcast world, and when I figured
out, it's
more
honest. It's definitely more honest and more representative, isn't it?
It's glorious, and you know, and I'm just so glad that you came on the show as well, and we were able to have this chat, because I really liked it. I see you very much as a kindred spirit. Also because, like, we're of a similar age and we've got similar glasses, and even
we're the same age. Yeah. We do look very similar,
we
don't
do we?
We
do look a bit. I'm a bit fatter, but but it's like you're like a sort of parallel me.
Yes, well, that, I think it's interesting that we're both very creative people, aren't we? And you're working in filmmaking, you know, it's a different type of visual medium, but we're still kind of dealing very much in images, and our brains are probably wired in a similar way. I think it's very interesting the way that there is a tendency with something like this that you do have the same opinion. And so often you'll find that people on the other side have completely different mentality and are good at different things to you.
Yeah, and it's wonderful, and it's just great just to be able to reach across the sort of internet and sort of find the real person on the other side that you can pull out and chat to, and find that, you know, one of the constant bits of feedback that I get, and I know that Liam and Alison get it on Planet Normal, I know that James gets it, I know that Toby gets it, is people saying, oh my god, thank you, like I thought I was alone.
Yes, you know,
and then, so the message is, oh, dear listeners, you're not alone, and there's Bob every 3 days a week your cartoons up.
They're four days a week.
Four days a week.
They're in the Telegraph on Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. But I got 2 days off this week because it's half term, so I'll only be in Saturday, Sunday.
And do you just do it right from home? You don't have to go into an office or anything. It's still
no. I had to at the beginning. I had to work in the office for the first 6 years.
Oh wow,
6 or 7 years, and we lived in Hampshire for a time. So I could commute in, and actually it was A, very exciting to begin with, being in a newsroom, and B, very necessary for me to learn what I needed to learn about the process and about how a newsroom works and about all kinds of practical things, and honing the craft. But then I reached a point where, obviously, having a family, it became difficult, and then I'd reached a stage where it was actually easier for me to be at home in my studio on my own, without all of the distractions. And I think it's, you reach a point as well where you need to have a slight disconnect with the newsroom in order to adopt the mentality of a newspaper reader, because which is who you're aiming your work at, I think. Otherwise you can get into a place where you're trying to do cartoons for the other journalists around you, and they think about the news in an entirely different way to the person who's going to be reading the paper over breakfast the next morning.
Yeah. Good little analogy as to why the media has pushed us into this crap in the first place.
Perhaps, yes.
So I would like to plug you as well. Your wonderful pictures, they don't have to simply go past on Twitter. You can buy them, right? You can get them delivered to your house, you can mount them yourself, so tell the listeners how they can do that.
Yes, all of my cartoons are, so I work traditionally, I paint them with watercolour and ink. They are actual real pictures, rather than digital files, and so you can buy the original artworks on my website, which is bobmoran.co.uk. They're currently selling quite fast, so you have to be quick with some of them. Just after I put them on Twitter, they usually go up for sale on the website. You can also buy rough sketches on there, so the sketches I will do in the morning that I send into the editors to let them know what I'm planning on doing. I sell some of those, and you can now buy prints of the picture we talked about with the Never Surrender Your Right to Be With the People You Love, with the people, the couple sitting on the hill.
Oh, well, I'm going to move house soon, and I'm going to finally build myself a little sort of shed in the garden. I'm going to have I hope I'll be able to, because I'm really bloody worried about my career, to be honest with you. Because TV production has gone down like 80% across the board. And, you know, lots of dependable gigs I had aren't there anymore. So I'm really going to have to muddle through in the next little while and hopefully survive, because I've lost tens of thousands of pounds, like, just as a minimum.
Sorry to hear that. It's awful. Yeah. But we have to cling to the hope that, you know, human beings cannot live without culture and entertainment and imagination.
And what's going to help me is I'm going to get one of those Never Surrender Your Right to Be the People You Love. And when I build my edit suite in the garden, I'm going to have that above my monitor, so it'll always be looking at me.
Well, that is a great honour for me, Alex. I'll be very glad to imagine it there, and I'll send you one.
Really?
I'll sort you out with one. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Thank you so much.
As a reward for all the great work you're doing. and for being so gentle with me on my first podcast.
I think I can say I showed you a good time.
Yes. Yeah, I won't sit down for a week.
it always comes out in the wash. Okay, so, Bob, thank you so, so much. This has been a really great podcast. I've really, really enjoyed chatting. And it's just been great to finally sort of talk to the man behind these wonderful images. You know, it's been fantastic.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Alex.
Listener, worry not. I have many fantastic guests coming up from, I'm reaching out. I've got people in the world of comedy coming on. I've got more scientists. And I'm really, really excited to bring what they have to say to you. So until then, don't let the shit get you down. And see you next time on Escape from Lockdown. Bye-bye.